أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطيبين الطاهرين. اللهم صل على محمد وآله. The subject tonight will be history of marja'iyat. And before I embark on the actual details of what transpired after the ghaybat, especially ghaybat al-kubra of our imam, I need to just try to prepare our mindset in order to understand what we're going to look at today. The important part is that if we isolate any of these events in history, any of these incidents in history, to try and isolate them and try and understand them and try and explain them, we will miss the mark. We will miss the plot. Because if we look at it holistically, we will find that from the time the Imam disappeared, went into Ghaybat al-Kubra, up to today, there has been a constant evolution of a system that is leading towards a certain goal. And that goal is establishment of rule according to Islamic Sharia. A government, you call it, a monarchy, an anarchy, whatever you want to call this, a kingdom, at the end of the day, it will be the rule established by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the kingdom of God as promised in all scriptures. So, to get to that, we have to go through so much changes. And I personally, having also studied this from the aspect of ghaibah as well, and the zuhur al-imam al-hujja ajalallahu ta'ala faraj al-sharif, you will find one of the reasons why the imam has not yet appeared is because we cannot comprehend the kind of system that he will put in place. So until we are ready, and what has been happening over history as we look at development of marja'iyat, what has been happening over history is this development has been taking place. This evolution has been taking place. So as we look at all these different phases of this development, you'll come to the same conclusion. And I just want you to understand that we are not looking at akhbaris or usulis, we are not looking at Najaf or Qum or Hilla or Jabal Amil, we are not looking at who corroborated with the kingdom at the time, Safavid dynasty or Qajar dynasty, or who fought against Pahlavi dynasty, who issued a fatwa against the British government. Those are all political moves. So we are not looking at the political impact, we are not looking at the social impact, we are looking at the development of marja'iyat. Now, what is marja'iyat? Secondly, again, in preparing our mindset, marja'iyat by any other name has been existing since the time of the Prophet. It is just the name that we are used to that is called marja'iyat. We have to understand the concept of marja'iyat. Marja' means reference point. That means if I don't know anything, I refer to somebody else. During the time of the Prophet, if the companions had any question, they referred to the Prophet. So the Prophet was in fact a marja. The Imams, same thing. Everybody would refer back to the Imams, and the Imams would answer, guide, give rules, issue edicts. These were the Imams. But the only thing was that we are now looking at development of such an authority in the absence of a ma'soom. We have the Holy Prophet and the Imams who are undisputably the only ones who are appointed authorities by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So, in their absence, what happened? Or rather, what happens? That's the question. So, the first phase we look at is the first era of traditionalists. If you look at from the time of the sixth Imam, after the time of the Holy Prophet, up to the time of the sixth Imam, the Sunnis were developing their own marja'iyat, their own ijtihad. We will today call it ijtihad. At that time, they would call it anything. But today, In retrospect, we would call it ijtihad, because the companions and the tabi'in, during the time of the Prophet, during the time of the Imams, up to the sixth Imam, introduced what is called qiyas as a way of understanding laws. So they would have history on one side, where the Prophet did this. On the other side, if anything new comes up that did not happen during the time of the Prophet, what would they use? They would use qiyas. And to use qiyas, they would use the lives of the companions. And that is why the lives of the companions to the Sunnis up to today is sacrosanct. You don't touch. You touch anything but the lives of the companions. Every companion. Right? Ashabi, there's a famous hadith. It says, Ashabi kan nujum. Right? My companions are like the stars in the sky. Now, the difference, that hadith is accepted by Shias and Sunnis. But the difference between the Shias and Sunnis is that the Sunnis have an added line which says, Bi ayyihim muqtadaytum ihtadaytum. That means, anyone who you take guidance from, you will get guided. Whereas we say, oh, companions, you know, because the definition of companions is those who have seen the Prophet, who have heard the Prophet. Abu Sufyan has heard the Prophet. Abu Sufyan has seen the Prophet. So what? You say you can seek guidance from a person like Abu Sufyan? So no. Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, salatullahi salamu alayhi, came into the picture and demolished. He actually built up a whole base of thinkers, of students, that you cannot rely on qiyas. There are certain principles. And the famous hadith that both Abbas and Sheikh Fadhil Milani spoke in their lectures about, where Imam talks to Ahmad bin Hanbal and says, Abu Hanifa, and says that I've heard you have started issuing edicts in Najaf, in Kufa. He says, but the people are asking me for rules and I give it to them. So the Imam then asked him that famous, what is worse, murder or adultery? And he replies, oh, murder is much worse. In any case, that was the time when the Imam introduced so many things and says, you cannot refer back to even the kingdom of the time, even though it is a Muslim empire. You have any problems? These are the rules. And that is why what we will see, I have at the end of the slides, one slide which has listed down the three main references in hadith, which is the basis of ijtihad, which form the basis of taqlid in Shiaism. That Imam Ja'far Sadiq al-Islam has said in the two hadiths, Maqbulat ibn Handala, Umar ibn Handala, and Maqbulat Abu Khadija. These two hadiths are during the time of the sixth Imam. And of course, the Tawqi' al-Sharif, which is the signed document by our Imam, which says, if you have any issues that need resolving, refer them back to narrators of our hadiths, to people who know what is halal and what is haram. So, marja'iyat is a concept that is referring back to people who know. After the sixth Imam, up to the 11th Imam, 12th Imam, and the first 70 years of lesser occultation, the Ghaibat al-Sughra, you have a very loose development of scholars who simply learned what the Imam was teaching. And so the teachings were by narration, by transferring oral traditions. The 7th Imam has said this, the 8th Imam has said this, the 11th Imam has said this. After the 12th Imam died, the 12th Imam disappeared in Ghaibat al-Sughra, the four Nawab had access to the Imam. And therefore people will go to the Nawab would say, now what? So the Imam would answer, this is the answer. And so the marja'iyat, the source of edicts, of fatwas, was just a hadith or aqwal al-imam, narrations from the Imam. So, you find reliance upon oral traditions, and one of the first works written is called Al-Usul Al-Arba'amiyah, That means 400 origins. Al-usul is original principles. 400. Why 400? Because this was taken from the lives of 400 different narrators. Unfortunately, we don't have that book anymore. Yeah, that work is non-existent. You must understand that during this period of evolution or development of marja'iyat, of development of Shiite history, you find that there have been so many burning of libraries, burning of books. In Sunni Shia fighting between the Sunni and the Shia, especially in Iraq. And therefore, a lot of these literature have been destroyed. A lot has been recovered from compiling from different resources. So, Al-Usul Al-Arba'amiyya, we have nothing remaining of that. And you find that post-Ghaybat al-Kubra, immediately, in the early years after Ghaybat al-Kubra, you find the first major works of Ahadith. The collection then was mainly ahadith. You have Basair al-Darajat by Ibn Furukh al-Safar al-Qummi, who died in 290 AH. And you have, of course, the famous works of al-Kulayni, al-Kafi. And you have Man la yahadaruhu al-Faqih, which is again, although the name says Man la yahadaruhu al-Faqih means somebody who does not have a faqih present. So who does not find a faqih, what does he do? So he opens the book. And in that book, there are ahadith. There are aqwal of imam, traditions from imam, that this is what you're supposed to do when you want to pray, when you want to fast, when you want to go to hajj. This is what you're supposed to do. And that was written by, of course, Sheikh As-Saduq, alayhi rahmah. So this was the first era, where up to the time of Sheikh Saduq, you find the concentration was on oral traditions. Of course, even Sheikh Saduq, alayhi rahmah, scholars like him were beginning to realize the inadequacy of relying on oral traditions. As times developed, as political movements progressed, as Islam spread, they realized that we have to do other things. We have to start picking up. And the first person to start talking about initial seeds of Usulism were by Abu Sahal al-Nawbakhti. Abu Sahal al-Nawbakhti was the teacher of Sheikh Mufid. Of course, Sheikh Mufid, in his time, was the one who developed the whole concept of Usul al-Fiqh, and he replaced Qiyas with Aql, because up to that time the Sunnis were powerful. Even in their thinking, even in their basis of knowledge, the Sunnis were very powerful. And Sheikh Mufid during his time had to come up with some argument to stop the penetration and infiltration of Sunni knowledge, the influence of Sunni knowledge in Shia development. So, Sheikh Mufid was the one who developed the first principles in Usul al-Fiqh and came up with replacing Qiyas with Aql, with reason. So, when you have the Quran, the Ahadith as sources, and then you have Ijma', again, Ijma' has been widely and loosely sort of accepted, rejected, changed. The kind of understanding of what consensus comprises. It's been, over the time, it's been changed. The definition has been changed. But Aql was never there. Because the Sunnis, and up to today, they strongly believe that we have no right to interfere. You've got to understand one thing. That when we talk of our Aql, and to use reasoning to derive fatwas, it does not come from our way of thinking or because we think we are very clever and therefore we can decide what we want to do. It is all based on certain parameters found in ahadith by the imam. And the best example I can give you is what exactly Ayatollah Fadhl Milani talked about when he was talking about the principles, when he said about this principle of la darar wa la dirar. When he said, no harm nor can you harm others. Right? In any transaction, in any action, you cannot harm yourself or harm others. Now, this is a principle that can be applied in any aspect of our lives. That principle, how do we apply it to different aspects of our lives, is what needs our akal. Right? And therefore, Sheikh Mufid alayhi rahma started this particular usulism. Now, it then went on to his student. And you can see the line from Sheikh Saduq to Sheikh Mufid. From Sheikh Mufid, you go to his student, which is Sharif al-Murtada. Sharif al-Murtada is also known as Alam al-Huda. He's the brother of Sharif al-Radi. Sharif al-Radi is the compiler of Nahj al-Balagha. And I'm sure you know the status of these scholars, these maraja, are so great in their piety, in their spirituality. They cannot be matched. We can't just flippantly pass a remark and say, but Sheikh Mufid did not understand. Because at the time, circumstances demanded a certain kind of action and Sheikh Mufid rose to that challenge. Not only that, in terms of piety and spirituality, when we hear of Sheikh Mufid and we hear of his two students, Sharif Murtada and Sharif Radi, the murder of Sharif Murtada and Sharif Radi brings the two young children to Sheikh Mufid to tell him that, I have brought my two sons, I want you to take them and nurture them and teach them under your patronage. And Sheikh Mufid says, it's only last night that I saw in a dream. And Fatima alayha salam comes to me with Hassan and Hussein and says, Mufid, teach my sons. Now, you can imagine the status of Sheikh Mufid, Sharif al-Murtada and Sharif al-Radi. These were not ordinary people, right? And they're the ones who progressed this. Sharif al-Murtada is renowned for his work Al-Dhari'ah, which is still available. These books that I mentioned here along this presentation, these are books that are used by fuqaha, by ulama, and are available in most of the libraries nowadays on a DVD and a CD as well. Those of you who know Arabic or Farsi, all you have to do is to order a CD, Jami' al-Ahadith, and you'll get all these books. Or Jami' al-Faqaha, Nur al-Faqaha, which is books only to do with fiqh from Nur Soft, which is the Qum organization. Al-Dhari'ah. And then his student, which is Sheikh Tusi. Sheikh Tusi was indeed a revolutionary. Because if Sheikh Mufid appeared to be somebody who was changing the tendencies, right, from basing it on a hadith to now use of intellect and reason, Sheikh Tusi, who was just a student of his student, two generations later, but Sheikh Tusi revolutionized the whole thing. And he wrote books that up to today are being used as two main sources. You know, there are four main sources, yeah? Al-Kafi, Man La Yahdaru Al-Faqih, Tahdhib Al-Ahkam and Istibsar. Tahdhib Al-Ahkam and Istibsar were written by Sheikh Tusi. These are the famous works that he has written, Al-Nihaya, Mabsut, Tahdhib Al-Ahkam, Istibsar, Ghaiba, Rijal. Rijal and Al-Fihrist are books on the narrators, the history of narrators. So taking it up to the imam, who are the reliable ones, who are the fabricated ones, Al-Fihrist and Al-Rijal are very reliable books. And you have Uddatul Usul. Uddatul Usul is again a book that lays down the basic principles to be used in fiqh. Remember, when you're talking of fiqh, there is fiqh on one side, that is the application, the derivation of fatwas and all that. But there is usul al-fiqh. And usul al-fiqh are the principle used, especially in the, you know, like la darar wa la darar and istishab and tabarra and khiyar, and all these are principles that allow us to use our intellect in arriving at a fatwa. So, Sheikh Tusi, those of you who have been to Najaf will remember the name because there is, as you go from Haram of Imam Ali al-Islam to Wadi Salam, as you go there, you pass the Jami' Tusi. His grave is there, and there is a whole mosque that is still under his name. A great scholar indeed. Now, from 656 AH, so we're looking at after around 4 centuries from the Ghaybat of the Imam, you find, because of political reasons, the schools in Baghdad, mind you, Iraq was the hot seat, yeah? Iraq was the development of all these things until then. And you find that because of political reasons, that will be a totally different subject. A lot of Shia houses were being destroyed in Iraq, a lot of fighting, students did not go there and so on. So the focus, development of fiqh in Shiaism moved from Baghdad and Iraq to Hilla. And I don't know if you've been to Hilla. Hilla is 20 kilometers from Baghdad. Still there. But I'm sure the name Hilli comes, because we've heard of so many names, Hilli, Alama Hilli. You will see today there is Muhaqqiq al-Hilli, Alama Hilli, and Fakhrul Muhaqqiqin. The three of them, very renowned scholars from Hilla itself. And so Hilla, because it was allowed that freedom, in fact, not only freedom, it was allowed, it was funded by Nasir Khwajaddin al-Tusi to actually develop the Hauza. So, Najmuddin Abul Qasim, again, if you read the names, it will not make any sense, because these names, Najmuddin Abul Qasim, Ja'far, you wonder who it is, bin Hassan, but when you came, AKA, that is also known as Muhaqqiq al-Hilli. Now the name makes sense, because Muhaqqiq al-Hilli, in his book Ma'arij al-Usul, introduces the concept of Addan, a concept that was later on developed by Sheikh Murtada al-Ansari around 150-200 years ago. But Addan is the, let's put it this way, you know what Dhan means? Dhan is conjecture. That means if you have a doubt, that is shak. Right, and then you have certainty, that is yaqeen. But then you have dhan. So in between, the shak and yaqeen is dhan. So you are inclined towards certain things. You think it is that way. Right? Now, Muhaqqiq al-Hilli developed this concept of dhan in Ma'arij al-Usul. This is his famous... based on theoretical considerations not deduced from the literal meaning of the tradition text. So when you have a hadith, there is a literal meaning, that is the zahar, you take from it. But there are considerations you are now taking into account before coming to a fatwa, which are not in the literal meaning of the text. But it is because of certain other leeway and parameters granted to you in other hadiths where you apply and come up with a hadith. That one was something that scholars until then were not audacious. And I use the term audacious because it required that boldness from the scholars to venture into these areas and say, all right, now I will venture into trying something that is not very clearly known, but my aql, my other ahadith, my indicators from so many different ahadith tell me I can do this. And that was what was started by Muhaqqiq al-Hilli. Mind you, at this stage, I must tell you that it is accepted from then until now, up to the Day of Judgment, that our Imam is the protector of our faith. And therefore he will not allow, or rather he cannot allow anything to happen to our mother. Agreed?
So we cannot have scholars guiding us all to the wrong path, because the Imam is responsible. All these are just his representatives. At the end of the day, today, the Imam is ultimately responsible for protecting our faith and practices. Whether he is in occultation or not, he's not audible. And therefore, these scholars slowly, slowly expanded on these things of, you know, giving fatwas, using not literal meanings, but implicit kind of indicators to issue fatwas, knowing that if they went wrong somewhere, the Imam would intervene. And so began this new era that Muhaqqiq al-Hilli also started what is called the concept of Niyaba al-Amma. Niyaba al-Amma is, you see, when you have Niyaba al-Khassa, which is Naib al-Khass, the four representatives of the 12th Imam. These were representatives of the 12th Imam knowing what to do. Now, we know the roles of the Imam. The roles of the Imam include, you know, not only just giving us fatwas, but it includes declaring jihad. It includes leading Friday prayers. It includes collection of taxes. All these things are included in the role of the Imam. During the earlier days, you will see that scholars were restricting themselves only to issuing fatwas. Even homes and collection of taxes came in later. Why? Because they did not have the boldness to actually go ahead and say, okay, all right, we will. The Niyaba al-Amma, as we see it today, did not start right from the beginning. It evolved. Where scholars slowly by slowly. And here is one, Muhaqqiq al-Hilli, who presented the concept of Niyaba al-Amma, that now, if somebody who has the ability from the ahadith of the Imams, from the teachings of the Imam, from the tafsir of the Quran, from using certain principles of fiqh to arrive at certain fatwas and to give guidance, then he can act as a general representative of the Imam. It doesn't have to be a specially appointed representative. Muhaqqiq al-Hilli's nephew was Allama al-Hilli, the famous Allama al-Hilli that we know of. Again, the famous Allama al-Hilli that we know of is the father. The father and son, Allama al-Hilli. The famous Allama al-Hilli, this one, the nephew of Allama al-Hilli, Muhaqqiq al-Hilli, was the father, and his son, Muhammad, was Fakhrul Muhaqqiqin. That means he was the pride of all investigators, as they call it. Muhaqqiq is somebody who investigates or researches. So, you have this Allama al-Hilli writing Tadhkiratul Fuqaha, and he developed further the concepts introduced by Muhaqqiq al-Hilli. And it went on. The Usulism gained strength in Hilla and move to Jabal Amil. Again, you will see these two places that were not part of Iraq or Iran. Jabal Amil is in Lebanon. And in there also, you find great scholars have passed who developed the concept of Usul Fiqh. And one of them is Shamsuddin Muhammad bin Makki, who was an indirect student of Allama al-Hilli. By indirect student, I would say because they were not geographically at the same place, obviously. Hilla and Jabal Amil are two different places. But there was some kind of correspondence where Shaheed al-Awwal, as he is known as Shamsuddin Muhammad bin Makki, must have learnt from Allama al-Hilli and acknowledged that I have learnt this from my ustad Allama al-Hilli, and therefore is then termed as an indirect student of Allama al-Hilli. He is the author of the famous works Al-Lum'a fi Fiqh al-Imamiyya. In fact, it's called Al-Lum'a al-Damishqiyya, right? Damascus light. And this concept, this trend of Usulism went on in Jabal Amil until this time. You're now looking at 1000 Hijri, which is early 17th century AD. So until that time, if you look at the two main phases that we've been looking at, we find that initially it was oral traditions and akhbaris. Then usulis came in for quite a long while. And even whilst wars were taking place in Iran and Iraq, Jabal Amil and Hilla grew up and produced illustrious scholars to develop these usuli tendencies. But then came the role of akhbaris again, where you got to understand one very important thing. That this was around the time the Safavid dynasty was established in Iran. The Safavid dynasty was had Sufistic tendencies, had extremists, and therefore they were more to do with the love and worship of imams. And therefore they hated the Sufis. They said, these people are, you know, keeping the imams on the side and just using their reason and intellect. And slowly, slowly, it started penetrating the teachings, the thinking of fuqaha. And you find the reversion back to reliance on traditions and less on aql. Mind you, the akhbaris, this era especially of akhbaris, it may be quite flippantly discarded today by saying, oh, those guys were just bent on traditions. It's not true. They relied on traditions more than aql. And they had a novel way of introducing reason, but a different way. And you will see that at the end of the situation, it is more or less the same thing, that these traditions have to be coupled with some intellect and reason in order to arrive at a fatwa. However, they had their own way, and they were more bent on progressing just ahadith, ahadith, ahadith. That is because they believed that the status of the imam is much more important than any usul principles that you want to apply to come to a fatwa. So you find Muhammad Amin al-Astarabadi, father of the Neo-Akhbari movement in the 17th century AD. And what he did was now the concept of dhan that was introduced by Muhakkik al-Hilli, right? And ijtihad that was then developed by Shahid al-Awwal. He replaced these two concepts and he said, no, you can't have dhan. Dhan is not yaqeen. And so you go to these two concepts by saying yaqeen al-adi and al-aql al-hissi. Not aql, it's aql al-hissi. Right? Whatever that means. Aql al-hissi and yaqeen al-adi. I mean, if you look at the literal translation, yaqeen al-adi is ordinary certainty. That means anybody can do it. Right? Certainty. There is no discussion, no dispute there. And sensitive reasoning. Again, reasoning with senses. Sensitive reasoning is a kind of definition for applying the same principles of usul, but not as widely and as freely as done by the usulis. So, this is what the akhbaris started with. And the akhbaris, during that time, remember, there is the Sufistic tendencies by the Safavid dynasty. There is the Ghulat movement as well during the same time. And you find in one corner, there were the philosophical development as well. And it is during this time of Akhbaris that you have scholars like Mullah Sadra and Mullah Mohsin Kashani who developed Sadruddin Muhammad ibn Ibrahim al-Shirazi, that is Mullah Sadra. He started writing Sharh Usul al-Kafi. Again, you can see the focus is on akhbar now. I come back to my original point. You look at it holistically. That after the original akhbari development, you had a period of 5 or 7 centuries that was just development of usul. Perhaps now there was time, it was time to revisit the traditions we have. This is exactly what happened. Whoever the akhbaris are, whatever happened, what actually happened, if you look at holistically, the historical picture, you will find that as a result of this movement, there was a new compilation and collection of ahadith, which is still going on, by the way. It's re-evaluation, now done with some usulistic tendencies. These narrations were revisited, recompiled, recategorized. You call it whatever you like. And some of the famous works, as you will see here, like Sadra, Mullah Sadra did the Sharh Usul al-Kafi. Now Usul al-Kafi needs explanation, right? Mullah Muhsin Faiz al-Kashani, he wrote the book Al-Wafi. During this era, there were new collections of traditions. You have Bihar al-Anwar, the famous work. The fundamental ahadith book that everybody refers to today. Bihar al-Anwar by Allama Muhammad Baqir Madlisi. You have Al-Wafi that I've already talked by Al-Kashani. And you have Wasail al-Shia by Muhammad bin Hassan, Hur al-Ami. Wasail al-Shia, if you open that book, you will find that the titles under which the hadith are categorized are actually titles of fiqh book. A hadith as to why, for example, namaz cannot be recited in usurped place, ghasbi place. So you find one, two, three, the hadith are there. The tendency was that if there is a hadith, in fact, the Akhbaris went to the length to say that even Quran was a secondary source. A hadith are the first source. You know why? Because it says Quran cannot be understood ordinarily without a hadith. So therefore, they used to claim, some, not all scholars, that even Quran is a secondary source. Primary source, a hadith. And this movement went on. Some of the things that came out were these collections of ahadith that are used up to today and are excellent resources for fuqaha. Until the time of Sheikh Yusuf al-Bahrani. Sheikh Yusuf al-Bahrani, who died in 1186, that is 1772, now we're arriving towards the end of the 18th century, right? Sheikh Yusuf al-Bahrani was an Akhbari scholar. And during his time, he had his student who started as an Akhbari and then turned against him and became an Usuli. This was Muhammad Baqir bin Muhammad Behbahani, also known as Wahid Behbahani. Again, these titles are something we'll look at towards the end if we have time. But he's known as Wahid. Wahid means unique, one of its kind, right? Unmatched. And that is why, because Behbahani is the new father of Usulis. He's the one who fought Sheikh Yusuf to such a way that he actually defeated the influence of Akhbaris. So Yusuf was a powerful scholar, but during his time, they had so many sessions together, so many debates together. Sheikh Behbahani rose to the level of saying that it is haram to recite namaz behind Sheikh Yusuf because of his Akhbari tendencies. And Sheikh Yusuf respected his own student, ex-student, Wahid Behbahani so much that he said, if I die, the only person to recite my janazah prayers is Sheikh Behbahani. And it so happened that Sheikh Yusuf, when he died, it was Sheikh Wahid Behbahani who recited his janazah prayers. But now, and you can see these concepts crystallizing, the titles that we are familiar to now. See, we are now familiar to Mujtahid, Marja, Marja-i Adam, Ayatullah, Ayatullah Udma. These are titles that were not there. At that time, there were Mullah, there were Hujjatul Islam. You know, at one time, was the title given to the most learned scholar. But nowadays, even up to very recently, Ayatullah was only given to a most learned scholar. But now Ayatullah has become so common that Al-Udhma had to be added to see that no, Ayatullah Al-Udhma is a marja. Otherwise, Ayatullah can be an ordinary mujtahid as well. Muhammad Baqir Bahbahani, Wahid Bahbahani, introduced the concept of mujtahid, where there was a certain parameter, a certain level up to which a scholar must learn in order to be able to issue fatwas. That was introduced by Bahbahani. And he called that scholar as a mujtahid. So whilst you may have other scholars below him, but until a certain level of studies have been accomplished by a student, he will not be called a mujtahid. And a mujtahid is somebody who is able to come to conclusions using the resources of Quran, Hadith, Ijma, and Aql. Bahbahani also was the first one to lay down the principles of how these mujtahideen start collecting the khums, zakat, radde madalim, and all other huquq that were of the imam, making scholars financially independent. Now we are coming to the actual cream of the development, because until now you will see that this might be academic and theoretical, yeah? And this is now in the world of academia, of maraja and ulama, right? But now you come to an era where there are now socio-political implications. There is outreach to the kings of the time. There are statements made in such a way that influence the decisions made by the government of the time. And one of his students, Sheikh Bahbahani's students, Sheikh Jafar Kashif al-Ghita. Kashif al-Ghita is a common name you must have heard so many times. Kashif al-Ghita means the... Kashif means to reveal, to uncover. Ghita is the cover, right? So he's the one who tore the curtain, as they say. He revealed the unknown. And he... Sheikh Jafar Kashif al-Ghita, who died in 1813, that is early 19th century, right? He is the one who now introduces the concept of al-Niyyah. Because as things progressed, you have a lot of mujtahids now. So first formalization was that level of ijtihad of mujtahid by Bahbahani. His student took it one up and said, there are so many mujtahids. If you want an analogy, the best way to compare it is with GPs, yeah? To become a GP, you have to finish a certain number of years in your studies. But once you become a GP, you cannot become a specialist. And therefore, al-Alamiyyah was important. Because two mujtahids can always have differences between them, interpretation. And al-Alamiyyah, of course, was not just introduced. It had its own basis, that it has to be on basis of experience, number of years of studies, ability to look at an issue through different perspectives, and so on. So, Sheikh Ja'far Kashif al-Ghita introduced al-Alamiyyah amongst mujtahideen. And his contemporary, again, another student of Muhammad Baqir Bahbahani, Mullah Ahmad Naraqi. Mullah Ahmad Naraqi, who died in 1830, he formulated that fuqaha can assume full authority of the imam. Now that Niyaba al-Amma encompassed all authority of the imam. You know, I must add here at this time that when I was in Iran, 2002. That's 10 years ago. At that time, I think Abbas was there, and many students, we were there, they were studying there. I had gone there for a wedding ceremony. And we went to see Sayyid Kamal Haidari. Sayyid Kamal Haidari is one of the contemporary scholars, you might have heard of him. And we went to see him, and one of the questions we asked him, right, we said, look, there is so much So many disputes in the world, so many fighting amongst the Shias. When will the Imam reappear? Once the Imam reappears, Abad Mati Jas. All this fighting and in-house thing will all shut down. And you know what he said? He said, one of the mistakes we make is that we think when the Imam comes back, right, we are looking for smooth operations. That there will be no confusion in fatwas, there will be no accusations in abuse of money or authority. We are confusing the role of the Imam to just that. We are reducing the role of the Imam. When the role of the Imam is much higher than that. See, those functions can be operated by an ordinary person. Don't need an Imam for that. So we are trying to understand the role of an Imam through a marja, we understand. We go to see Ayatollah Sistani and say, what does Ayatollah Sistani do for us? He gives us guidance, he tells us this, he gives us rules, he collects our money. And therefore, we are thinking that when the Imam comes, what will happen is the differences will die down between Maraja. But that is not the case. When the Imam comes, the Imam is the spiritual connection between this earth and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The Imam has functionality that we cannot even begin to comprehend. And here we are, trying to find out how we can improve our lives here, you know, in our day-to-day operations, and say, where is the Imam? Because what? We want a smooth life? So, when this thing, Mullah Ahmad Narak, you know, when I was reading this, it made a lot of sense. That Mullah Ahmad Naraqi is not saying that a person becomes an Imam. Since the functionality of an Imam in his relations to people can be done by ordinary people. And that is leading them, guiding them, praying for them, you know, spiritually or fiqh-wise, legally, whatever. That was a concept developed by Mullah Ahmad Naraqi, who died in 1830. And one of the most classic was the I think it was the prime time of ulama in Iraq. This is now back to Iraq. Huh? You have Muhammad Hassan bin Maqar al-Najafi. After the concept of A'lamiyya that was declared by Sheikh Jafar al-Ghita, Kashif al-Ghita, his student, Muhammad Hassan al-Najafi. Muhammad Hassan Baqar al-Najafi is the Sahib Jawahir al-Kalam. Jawahir al-Kalam is a famous book, 10 volumes. He was one of the first ones to be declared the sole marja amongst all mujtahideen. Everybody unanimously agreed that if there is anybody who is as learned as the Imam would be if was present, is this guy. And therefore, the whole Shia kingdom looked up on this one personality, Muhammad Hassan bin Baqir al-Najafi, who again is buried in Najaf. I think it is on the right side, opposite Wadi Salam. But there is Jami' al-Jawahiri, because now his descendants are called Jawahiri, al-Jawahiri. You have Sheikh, I know his grandson, fourth generation, Sheikh Hassan al-Jawahiri, who is the Imam of the Mosque of al-Jawahiri in Najaf. And he is also writing books on fiqh. So the Jawahiri family is a very renowned family. And he was also the first one to start kind of practices. He was the first one to send deputies all over the Shiite kingdom. And such that all his deputies were responsible for his functions. So even collection of money, if anybody came to him directly, he would send it back. He says, where are you from? So he says, from Tehran. He says, Tehran, I have this representative, go and give it to him. Baghdad, I have this representative, go and give it to him. A very pious person who had millions flowing in his coffers, even at that time, but who died a poor man. And these are the spirituality and the piety of these people as we talk of Sheikh Muhammad. I always think of him as Al-Jawahiri. But he was also the first one to set forward what we have today as Risala al-Amaliyya. Risala al-Amaliyya we have is a book, a concise guide of what to do in ibadat, in mu'amalat. So that is from marja al-taqlid to muqallad, muqallid. That means if I am doing taqlid of a certain person, I need a textbook that tells me what are his rules regarding all the practices. Najat al-ibad. Of course, today's Risala al-Amaliyya, and you find all these Tawzih al-Masail and Fatawa al-Islamiyya and all these different books, Tahrir al-Wasila, all these different books are on a model that was developed later. But the first one to introduce such a concept of a book as a guide between the Marja and Muqallid was Sheikh Muhammad Hassan bin Baqir al-Najaf. He was a sheikh, by the way. And again, his student, when he died, because he was the sole marja, when he died, he passed over the baton to his student, who was none other than Sheikh Murtada al-Ansari. Sheikh Murtada al-Ansari, again, is a name that he again revolutionized. He further revolutionized the concepts. He was the one who developed further the concept of dhan. That had been started by Muhaqqiq al-Hilli. He had a unique way in which you give him any issue, he would slice it in five different ways and give you different perspectives. This was Sheikh Murtada al-Ansari. He entrenched the position of Usulis, and after Sheikh Najafi, on his death, Sheikh Najafi al-Jawahiri appointed and said, after me, Sheikh Murtada al-Ansari will be your sole marja. Sheikh Murtada al-Ansari was, again, one of the richest maraja. Financially, the kings were afraid of these guys. Why? Because they were independent. They were not afraid. They were pious. And they had a following that the kings could not enjoy the same level of dedication by their followers. The kings were kings, rulers. But here was somebody who was sitting in a small hut, yet commanded the respect of millions of Muslims. Right? He was the undisputed sole marja taqlid during his time. He passed away in 1864. Holy Christ, what happened? I'm sorry. This is the Arabic version. I don't know. I had it originally. Somehow, I think the yeah. But this thing is the first one is Tawqi' al-Sharif, which is in Kanz al-Ummal. Kamal al-Din wa Tamam al-Ni'mah by Sheikh Saduq. The Tawqi' al-Sharif of the 12th Imam, which says that wa amma al-hawadith al-waqi'ah, new developments. فَرْجِعُوا إِلَى رُوَاتِ حَدِيثِنَا فَأَنَا حُجَّتِ حَدِيثِنَا فَإِنَّهُمْ حُجَّتِي عَلَيْكُمْ وَأَنَا حُجَّتُ اللَّهِ عَلَيْهِ. Right? That is what he says. That they are my hujjat to you and I am Allah's hujjat. So this was the 12th Imam saying, رُوَاتِ حَدِيثِنَا, those who narrate our hadith. This is found in Kamal al-Din wa Tamam al-Ni'mah by Sheikh Sadduq in page 484. Then you have Maqbulat Umar bin Hanbala, where he is talking to the Imam and saying that if there is a dispute between two people, is it right that they take the dispute to rulers of the time, to the Qadi, to the judges of the time? And the Imam prohibited it and said it is haram. That is Maqbulat Umar bin Handala. Again, in the same hadith, he said, Yandurani ila man kana minkum. That these two, whoever dispute or have a misunderstanding, should look at from amongst yourselves, man qad rawa hadithana, somebody who has narrated our hadith, wa nadara fi halalina wa haramina, and has studied what is halal and haram. وعرف أحكامنا, and knows our rules. فليرضوا به, then let them be pleased with him. فليرضوا به حكما, as a judge, as a referee. فإني قد جعلته عليكم حكما. I have appointed that kind of a person over you to solve your disputes. Now, this is again مقبولة عمر بن حنظلة. This is narrated by عمر بن حنظلة from the Imam. And the last one is مقبولة أبو خديجة. أبو خديجة was also a companion of the Imam, where the Imam sent him to convey a message to a certain group of people. Where he says, Abu Khadija says, the Imam told me to tell, to convey to people, اِجْعَلُوا بَيْنَكُمْ رَجُلًا. مِمَّنْ قَدْ عَرَفَ حَلَالَنَا وَحَرَامَنَا. So make from you amongst your person who understand what is halal and what is haram. فَإِنِّي قَدْ جَعَلْتُهُ قَاضِيًا. I have made him a qadi amongst you. So these are three narrations which form the basis of understanding how the concept of ijtihad and marja'iyat has developed. Now, just to end, I know it's been quite long. Last thing before I open up for questions is... that from then up to now, after Al-Ansari, who are the scholars? And I just want to name the scholars so that we become familiar with who are the Muraja'a from Sheikh Murtada Al-Ansari, who died in 1864. It's just about 100 years before I was born, right? So he died then. Who were the Muraja'a from that time up to the time? And you will see, we know all these people. You have Mirza Hassan Shirazi, who moved to Samarra, and he was the only deviation from Najaf. He, from all that time, from Sheikh Murtada Al-Ansari, from Sheikh Hassan and Najaf, it has been Najaf. But Mirza Hassan Shirazi, he moved into Samarra and he ruled as a marja, taqlid from Samarra, until he died in 1895. Again, I'm giving you 80 dates now so that you know. After him, there was Muhammad Kadhim Tabatabai al-Yazdi. So Muhammad Kadhim Tabatabai al-Yazdi is the one who wrote Urwatul Wuthqa. Urwatul Wuthqa is from where all these Rasail al-Amaliyah come. See, the current model of what we have in Tawzihul Masail and Tahrirul Wasila or whatever books, Minhaj al-Salihin, all these are based from Urwatul Wuthqa, that was originally written by Muhammad Kadhim Tabatabai. He died in 1918. So from 1895 to 1918, he was the sole marja'i taqlid. Now, I am giving you names of prominent scholars. There were many other scholars at the time, huh? But the prominent ones who demanded or commanded the following were these guys. Then you have Muhammad Taqi Shirazi, who was there for only 2 years. He passed away in 1920. And after that, you have Muhammad Hussain Naini, who passed away in 1936. And then comes a name that a picture I first saw in Africa. You have Sayyid Abul Hassan Al-Isfahani, who died in 1947. So from 1936 to 1947, 11 years, Sayyid Abul Hassan Al-Isfahani. In fact, the first time I heard that name was a picture I saw in Mombasa. A small picture and say, oh, who is this? It's Abul Hassan Isfahani. From there onwards, you have after him, Ayatollah Burujardi. Ayatollah Burujardi for 15 years, from 1947 to 1962. He was the undisputed leader of Maraja, of Mujtahideen. And of course, I don't need to give you names after that, because from there on, you have Sayyid Mohsin al-Hakim, Ayatollah Khoi, Ayatollah Sistani, and so on. This is just to give you an idea of the chronology of the scholars. Now, with that, I'd like to end just to let you know that there are so many things that I haven't even talked about. We haven't discussed the political influence of these scholars what time they interfered, what time they did these things. We haven't discussed that at all. But that is altogether for another time. Thank you very much. Wa sallallahu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi al-tayyibin al-tahirin.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa alihi.
Jihad.
You mentioned earlier that there was a stage when ijtihad was set as a parameter to become known as a mujtahid.
Yes.
And then after that, then there was a stage of becoming the
marja, a'lam.
I don't know if this is true or not, but I'm getting like the vibes that we've reached a stage where there's many a'lam now, or at least reaching to that. What happens next?
I think the question here is that when time demanded and circumstances demanded to differentiate between the levels of a mujtahid and a marja. So you had mujtahid and then you had a'lamiyya to establish the marja of the marja'iyya. So now we're coming to a time where there are several a'lams together. And so what happens next? That's the question, right? I think very interesting the hadith of Umar bin Handala, the Maqbulat Umar bin Handala, is something that you have to read because it's a very lengthy hadith. It's a 2-page hadith. I have just quoted you just one sentence. Yeah, it's found in Al-Kafi, volume 1, page 68. In that hadith, Umar bin Handala asks the same kind of questions. He says, but what happens if the two have differing views? If the two are equally learned? If the two are equally respected? Then what do we do? And the Imam takes him along the phases. And that's where I am, I think, not be that, but that's where the A'lamiyyat and all that is based from. Ultimately, it boils down to the simple thing, that within the A'lamiyyat, there has to be an A'lam. Right? What we are facing now is different forces at play. If you look at the lives of Sheikh Najafi, right, and Sheikh Murtada al-Ansari, and Abul Hasan Isfahani for that reason, up to 1947, you will find that during their time there were several maraja, but they had the spirit in them to themselves say, no, this one is more learned. And therefore, the direction towards the most learned was something that was very clear. In fact, most of these Orientalists who have written books on the development of Maraja and Marja'iyya write the same thing, that the spirit reflected in the works of scholars in the 18th and the 19th century differs vastly from the scholars today. So whilst, with all due respect to scholars today, it is not the scholars, it is the way the structure is emerging today. You find that there is, it is being shrouded, it has been clouded, right, by political forces, by financial forces, as to who is the A'lam. But there lies very certainly an A'lam within the A'lam. That's my belief. Any other questions? Yes, Ali.
Two-part question, if you don't mind. You mentioned that a number of responsibilities of the maraja have developed over time, and one of them, the example you gave, was khums. The collection of khums appeared somewhat later, maybe 500-600 years, maybe more late, beyond the minor quotation. What happened in that interim period? Did the Muslims pay khums, and if so, to whom? Or if not, what do they do with that tax upon them?
That's a good question. What happened in the interim period? Did the Muslim pay homes? Because until the time it was formalized structure that the marja would be collecting on behalf of the imam, until that time it was considered an individual duty. In fact, there were people who would think that this is for the imam, and that I wouldn't say extremist tendency, but that tendency, naive tendency, that look, the imam when he appears, when he reappears, he will need the money, right? And actually what we're doing is we're collecting khums, let it amass until the imam reappears because he will need that resource. That thinking was also present amongst his believers to the extent that people buried money and say, kya mein aali kaidos. Right? At that time, there were no banks and all that. So, dig a hole in the garden and bury the gold or money or whatever they had. So the imam will come and he will know where it is. So, but it was either that, which was minority, but it has been reported in the Rishad, or people dispersing themselves. Individual duty, just like namaz or hajj, you have to do it yourself. Until the structure developed. That now, to look after the welfare of Shias worldwide, there has to be a hierarchy. And in the absence of the imam, the Naib imam is taken. That's a follow-up question.
The second part of the question is, you mentioned also in your talk that the imam is the authority and the protector of our faith and religion.
Yes.
If Qums, for example, and many other things were personal responsibility, not undertaken by a single person, and that the imam has not intervened during those many hundred years to correct this practice, is that an implication that, therefore, it is an accepted practice that such responsibilities, like Qums or any others, are equally either a personal duty or a duty of the manager?
I take what you are saying, but on the other side of the coin, the very fact that it is now a unanimous by all scholars that it is obligatory, and that also has not been intervened by the imam, that means that obligation is cut. I mean, you know, on the flip side of it. Now, the question would be that from that era, you were living at a time where it was accepted. Now, we're living at a time where it is not accepted, not to pay homes, right? And therefore, would it suffice to act according to things that happened so many years ago? It wouldn't. Because you can't extrapolate yourself from time to time. Because at that time there were different rules, different circumstances. Today there are different rules, different circumstances. Yes, sir.
A founding premise of our school is, as I've said, and as every scholar has said so far, that the 12th Imam is a protector of our school. He won't allow our school to go astray, etc., etc., etc. But we see so much conflict within our school, not just today on petty things like the day of Eid or whatever, but on core fundamental things, such as Akbari, Usuli complex, etc., etc. Where was the 12th Imam for all these centuries? When did he intervene and tell one alim or another that actually this is a bit wrong? Let's go this way.
Let me put it this way. That, again, I come back to the original question. When you look at it from an overall perspective, you find that the Akhbaris had a contributory role to development of fiqh, of marjahiyat, right? Whilst they may not be the right choice, they may not have been the perfect one to lead, they were important for the development of the fiqh, of the marjahiyat. And that is why you will find that unless there is dire sort of, you know, straying from the falsehood, from the truth to falsehood, the imam will not interfere. Yeah?
But this straying away from protection, I always thought, was an aspect of Sunni schools. Because in Shia, the reason we always looked towards the imam as our leader was because we looked for protection. We didn't look for anything less than that.
Come again, sorry, you couldn't.
Within our school, I always thought that we strove for protection, which is why we always looked for the imam as our leader. So, this straying away from perfection seems something from other schools, not from within our own.
Straying away from?
Perfection.
Perfection?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You said just now that as long as our school didn't go into something very dire, the Twelfth Imam did it like that.
Yeah.
But don't we always strive for perfection? Why didn't the Twelfth Imam lead us towards perfection?
You see, Imamiya school, yes, perfection is, you're looking at two different levels. Perfection, one is at the spiritual level where you want to become a perfect proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, right? But when you look at practices, I'll tell you one simple example. Today, if I am the muqallid of, say for example, Fadallah, Sayyid Fadallah, right? I, according to my own choice, my own conviction, I am convinced he is the learned, most learned, and I follow him. And he says, for example, you can eat Hindu food. I eat Hindu food, right? You don't, because you're doing the taqlid of Ayatollah Sistani, who says it is haram. Right? Now, the diversity is more than just diversity. It's not just difference. It is contradicting on a simple issue. Right? Who is right? Who is wrong? The fact that the imam has not intervened to say that Fadlallah is wrong, right, does not make Fadlallah right, does not make me right. What happens is that in this whole development, I have my own role to play, you have your own role to play, but what has not happened is that we have not digressed to batil, right? I will be judged according to my intentions. I am following Fadlallah because of a reason. If at all there is any khalal, you know, any dispute in my reasoning that I am doing it because of my own convenience, because I'm living in India or I like to eat Hindu food, that's why. It's my responsibility. Right? Now, bottom line is, the imam will only intervene, if there is straying from, not from perfection, from, becoming from haq to batil. That's all. Otherwise, within haq, a lot of things are acceptable, and owing to human errors, life will carry on. It is altogether another subject, which I hope Sheikh Bahman Pool will cover as well in his topic, inshallah. But it's an interesting topic.